Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
From Studio A in Podcast Village, Upper Georgetown, Washington, D.C., this is the best political talk show you've never heard of. It's Backroom Politics with your host and moderator, Justin Russell.
And welcome to the best political talk show that you've never heard of. And I am not Justin Russell. Justin Russell is north of the border celebrating with the Toronto Raptors their NBA championship or doing something north in Canada. That said, I am your guest host, Dan Lipner, former guest star of the show, but acting as the guest host. Across from me this afternoon is Alan Moore. Alan, how are you doing today?
I'm well, thanks.
Also joining us on the phone is your retired one-star admiral, Ken the Admiral Carradine. Ken, how are you doing today? That good. Ken is probably sitting there listening to some Village People right now. Also joining us on the show this afternoon is Rich Rubino, former Huffington Post writer and political author. Rich, how are you doing this afternoon?
Sensational.
Outstanding. And trying again. Ken, are you with us or are you still MIA?
I'm doing well. Thank you for asking. I appreciate it. Hello.
We have Ken Carradine. Outstanding. So there's a lot of things going on in the news this week, and the president has been taking a lot of actions. But most notably is what started a little over 6 months ago and has had some additional news today. Our acting Secretary of Defense, Secretary Shanahan, is no longer in the game. He has removed himself from consideration, and he was acting Secretary of Defense for about 6 months. Alan Moore, what happened here?
Well, not only is he no longer the president's choice for secretary, he is stepping down as deputy secretary. What happened here, last week there were some reports that we discussed on this show, but they were very fresh reports that the president was inquiring of some other foreign leaders how they felt about the deputy secretary, the acting secretary, Patrick Shanahan. And that word got around, as these things tend to, because people talk. And we were trying to figure it out. It wasn't that unusual for this president to have second thoughts about all sorts of people. It's not so in that regard, it wasn't that unusual. It was a bit of a surprise today, but the reports that are out there suggest it was not necessarily the president's second thoughts. It's hard to sort that out, but the fact that 9 years ago, Acting Secretary Shanahan, soon to be former Acting Secretary Shanahan, and perhaps he's got that status even now, was involved in domestic conflict with his former wife. There were allegations that he hit her. He was never charged with that. She was charged with hitting him. But sadly, underneath all of that was a much more violent confrontation in 2011 between her then 17-year-old son, the ex-wife, and the ex-wife, who, not to put too fine a point on it, took a baseball bat to her, fractured her skull and an elbow. He was a minor. He was charged. He spent some time at a youth camp. Apparently, since then, there's been no allegations of continuing violence. He recently graduated from college. Tragic story, but frightening story that had never before gotten into the public eye, not when he went through his confirmation process to be deputy secretary. The controversy at that time being that he was a senior Boeing company executive, and was that the appropriate was deputy secretary the appropriate place for such a person? And that had always been the focus, even in the conversation about him becoming the secretary. He's now out. Whether he's removed himself or he's been removed, he's out and he's leaving the department. And the new acting secretary named by the president is the current Secretary of the Army, Mark Esper, who's been serving in that position now, actually confirmed and serving in that position. And there is so far no known controversy about him, but we're just getting started.
Well, this is the Trump administration after all. Admiral Ken, what does this kind of leadership change at the top of the Pentagon mean, both when you were both in service and since? What does that mean based on your perspective and your experience?
So let's talk about what the Pentagon is and what it is not. So the Pentagon is... And the Department of Defense, and I use those terms interchangeably, maybe not appropriate, but I do. The Department of Defense is a very hierarchical organization. And you know what? I think that most people assume that that is the case, and it is. Now, I will say that at the general officer and flag officer and senior civilian SES level, there's some level of politics going on because – you know, whenever you introduce people, there's always going to be some level of politics. But by and large, it's a very hierarchical organization. So if there's any concern that the business of the nation and the business of the nation's military is not going to get done, let me allay you of those concerns right now. That part of the mechanism is working. The Secretary of Defense primarily is a policy advisor for the President of the United States on the use of military and what can be done legally and what they have available in the way of military resources if those resources are planned to be used. So, you know, with Acting Secretary Shanahan in the job, the only thing that he probably does not have is the same gravitas that some of the other, you know, confirmed secretaries, cabinet secretaries have. But by and large, people are saluting him, giving him the aye-aye or the yes, sir, and they're carrying out his directives. And so what I will say is that it takes some number of days, weeks, or months to get up to speed in that job. Taking someone, as was the case with Ash Carter working Chuck Hagel, moving Ash Carter into that job was a lot easier to do than taking somebody from a different department, even the Department of the Army, and move them into that job. It takes some amount of time to get up to speed. You know, a lot's been said, both seriously and jokingly, about the revolving door that is the Trump administration. But I think that just because the organization is as hierarchical and as structured as it is, there's probably less chaos in this move than there might be in other less structured organizations.
So, Admiral Ken, you bring up a good point with the turnover in the Trump administration. And actually, there was just I believe this is the Brookings Institute that was crunching some numbers, and I believe had the Trump administration's turnover as a record high of any administration in the history of the country.
I heard that.
Rich Rubino.
President loves records.
As long as he doesn't have to preserve his own records. Rich Rubino, as far as administrations go and turnover, how does the Trump administration compare to, I don't even know, who do you have as number two as far as this kind of chaos and this kind of turnover in an administration, Democrat, Republican, or other administration?
Yeah, well, I think that this is almost unprecedented, but I would just say a few historically. One of them would be the Carter administration. And what happened back in 1979 when Jimmy Carter's job approval rating was falling, you know, he came in there, he was very popular, his job approval was set about in the 70s at one point because of the energy crisis mostly, but also the Iranian hostage crisis. He had a crisis of his own, so he went to Camp David, and a bunch of people, Bill Clinton was one of them, a governor of Arkansas, Governor Budsby, the governor of Georgia, a bunch of people got together and they said, what can we do to reform the administration? He comes down from Camp David and he fires six cabinet officials and puts in new people. That would be one example of a very quick turnaround. It certainly didn't work for him as he lost re-election, you know, winning six states. The other example would be Richard Nixon. After Richard Nixon was reelected in 1972 on Election Day, he was kind of disconsolate. Everyone else was so happy he'd won 49 states. The only places he lost were Massachusetts and District of Columbia. Everyone was saying it's a great day, but he was relatively depressed. So he had his chief of staff go to the cabinet and said, basically, you're all volcanoes now, and they changed administration that way. Generally speaking, you know, they serve at the president's pleasure. In terms of cabinet officials, and you do have that scenario where a cabinet secretary resigns, then certainly an acting cabinet secretary, just like in other positions, an acting cabinet secretary comes in, and there's relatively little change. The acting secretary is usually there as kind of a caretaker, more or less, until somebody else comes into power. But as I say, it's very rare to stay in for your entire administration.
Clinton's administration, as far as the cabinet secretaries, were actually remarkably stable. You are correct about the attorney general slots, but I believe three or four of his secretaries were there for his entire 8-year term, including the Secretary of Education, as you pointed out.
Richard Riley, yep.
The AG, and I believe there are a couple others as well. That said, the going without a Secretary of Defense or only an acting Secretary of Defense for 6 months, this feels more than a little unusual. Have we had that higher ranking official be essentially acting or a vacancy in that seat for that long?
I don't think for that long. Usually, other than just the fact that there's a transition and somebody takes over, but usually the president has somebody in place that will come in and will succeed the former secretary. And usually it's whether the secretary is fired or the secretary simply just says that he's not going to serve another term. There's somebody that's going to come in. I will say that I remember in terms of defense secretary, the last one I can think of that was really became unpopular, going back to the Clinton administration again, was probably Les Aspin. And Les Aspin, I know that there was the debacle in Somalia. So Les Aspin ended up leaving, but another Secretary of Defense came in. And eventually during the second Clinton administration, he actually had a Republican in there who had been a critic of him for his policy in Bosnia, and that was Bill Cohen, the former senator from Maine. And to show the bipartisanship in terms of foreign policy, Barack Obama also did that when he nominated Chuck Hagel, who was the former senator from Nebraska, who became defense secretary and actually ran into a lot of problems with his former ally John McCain and Lindsey Graham because they didn't think that he was vociferous enough in his support for the Israeli regime, and they had asked him some questions during that hearing. But Chuck Hagel, I think, was seen at that time, at least on defense issues, as more of a Democrat than he was a Republican. He certainly served out a couple years, and then eventually. Eventually, you have 2 or 3 years, and then eventually most people burn out and somebody else comes in. But you're right, in terms of the Clinton administration, there was certainly a lot of people that served in there for a very long period of time.
So along those same lines, and thank you for introducing the other topics of some of those crises that Secretaries of Defense have dealt with in the past and the vacancy that is currently sitting in only an acting role for Secretary of Defense that it'll be dealing with as far as currently Iran. The administration has released a claim that the Iranians were pulling at least a mine out of the Strait of Hormuz. And the question is, well, is this credible? Without a Secretary of Defense, does that potentially harm us? If there is a military confrontation, the fact that our allies are now pushing back, claiming they need more evidence regarding whether or not this is credible. And on top of that, is this a slam dunk, to quote a former CIA director on weapons of mass destruction in Iraq? So is this a slam dunk with Iran? And should our allies just trust us on this? Alan Moore.
Boy. It remains to be seen. I'm real interested to hear what the admiral has to say on this particular subject. We have we have made a decision. The president has made a decision to poke Iran. It canceled the Iran nuclear deal. It reimposed sanctions against Iran and the sale and shipment of Iranian oil. It has put enormous pressure on our allies, some of whom, of course, were parties to the agreement with Iran.
It's worth noting, everyone claims, including our own folks, that the Iranians were upholding their side of the bargain.
That is correct. There was a lot of debate, of course, about the nature of the bargain itself. It did not have the status of a treaty. Which was pointed out at the time, made it vulnerable to a new president coming in and making changes. But it was a multinational. Agreement. All reports I've seen were that they were upholding the letter of the agreement, even as they were doing other provocative things internationally, but things that were not covered in the agreement. So the president canceled the agreement, moved to reimpose the sanctions, put a lot of pressure on foreign governments and foreign companies to live by those sanctions in order to avoid sanctions against them by the United States. So the Iranians now are in this position where they're urging, where they're talking to these other countries. These other countries are urging Iran to continue to live by the agreement. And it was reported this week, of course, that Iran is a mere 10 days away from reaching the ceiling in that agreement on the amount of nuclear material that it is allowed to hold in the agreement. The question is, are they going to exceed that amount? Are they going to exceed the elements of the agreement that these other European, other international bodies are trying to hold on to and maintain?
So that's actually a very good point, and a very interesting point before we throw to Admiral Ken, that part of that, their additional refining of fissile material has been announced by them that they can do this in 10 days, which I thought was kind of odd. It's coming across as a press release as opposed to a security briefing from the National Security Advisor. And that seems interesting and both provocative, potentially to open the door for negotiations from the Iranian side.
It is provocative on the one hand. There's a strategy behind it, which is not yet obvious, but they were going to be found out. If they tried to do this secretly, then this would get them crossways with the other European, the other international partners, all of whom are urging Iran to continue to live by the agreement. Now, the question is what happens as they continue to enrich uranium and get to the point where they're at their ceiling, what do they then do? Do they stop or do they continue to enrich? Do they've indicated they're 10 days away. What is their intention? What are they trying to get from the other nations that were party to the agreement? What will the president do? The president, the Defense Department sent 1,000 more troops to the region. So it's not clear what Iran is up to. It's not clear what the U.S. will do. It's not clear what the other parties will do. There's reason for some nervousness all around.
Admiral Ken, from your perspective, both military and as far as just a negotiation posture, what do you think is going on and how do you think the United States is handling itself thus far in this latest little struggle?
So I as I listened to this, my mind went to the latest episode of Designated Survivor, where they showed the character of the President of the United States playing with the Rubik's Cube while he's sitting on the toilet.
Ken, where are you recording the show from? Just so I know.
Netflix, baby. It's great. With the Netflix. On the issue of Iran with the fissile material, so you know, I'm thinking that they have to have watched the president's behavior toward North Korea and Kim Jong-un, and I guess in the back of their minds, okay, so he basically trashed a treaty that we really didn't want to sign, And we said, okay, we'll live by this thing. And while we're doing what we're supposed to do, you know, he basically, gave us the big fat middle finger. In Trump's hand, Trump's version, I guess, the little fat middle finger. And so now they're thinking, okay, so what do we got to do to get some respect from this guy? Well, he respects the heck out of Kim Jong-un, and what's he got that we don't have? Nukes. Well, hey, let's see how this works out. So the JPOA was not a perfect document. I probably was one of, you know, a number of retired flag and journal officers who went on record saying, yeah, this is probably not a good deal. But once it was in place, okay, let's go. And the thing that I think the Trump administration does not get and still hasn't figured out yet is that you need allies to help you enforce your wishes on countries that are not behaving appropriately. And the JPOA, you know, by trashing it, we turned a blind eye and a deaf ear toward our allies yet once again. And I think what's really interesting is that on the international stage, those pictures of the Iranians possibly removing or placing a limpet mine on the side of a tanker, they're falling on deaf ears. And I think the main reason for that is there's just been so many lies, so many half-truths, and so much chaos from this administration that they really don't know what to believe. And I think that what's creating that's going to create a situation where things are getting really dangerous in the Straits of Hormuz. The Iranians can really shut it down, and it'll turn into a big Navy fight, and we'll get to, you know, spin off, you know, a few billion dollars worth of missiles and torpedoes to clear it up again. But, you know, as someone who served in uniform, the last thing I want to do is fight, and I don't want to do that unless I have to. And this doesn't make sense that we're pushing these guys down this road. It doesn't make sense. And I think, quite frankly, you know, there's a school of thought that the only reason that President Trump killed JPOA is because it was an Obama accomplishment.
So Rich Rubino, so in that same context, and maybe the Trump administration deserves a little leeway here, and I mean that tentatively, that all of this wasn't exactly their own fault as far as people having skepticism in the United States position. I made a reference to the former director of the CIA referring to the case of weapons of mass destruction production in Iraq as a slam dunk. Is this all the Trump administration, or is this also the ghost of Christmas past being visited upon this administration as well?
Oh no, it's definitely the ghost of Christmas past. You can go back to so many the USS Maine in 1898. You can go back to the Gulf of Tonkin resolution where the United States Senate literally voted unanimously. I mean, the United States House of Representatives voted unanimously to give President Johnson a blank check, and the United States House of Representatives, the United States Senate, only had two abstentions. And then later we found out that it did not actually happen. At least the second attack did not happen. Certainly, the case that was made in Iraq was so incontrovertible. When George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, they weren't saying we have on the best intelligence. They were essentially saying they have them. They have weapons of mass destruction. There is a nexus between Al Qaeda and Iraq, which of course there wasn't. They were using such concrete language. And then, of course, it turned out that everything that they were saying was mendacious. So I think that that's certainly President Trump is not the first president to have gone through this. But there's just such skepticism. There's so many people now saying, is this some sort of a false flag here? There's almost a hyperbolic skepticism here. But in terms of President Trump's taking away the Obama administration's agreement, you got to remember, try to think of this in terms of somebody from an Iranian perspective. So the sanctions that were put in place under the Obama administration are taken off, they're dislodged. Now all of a sudden these sanctions are for no apparent reason are put back on the Iranian people. I think sometimes when we say sanctions, we say it more of kind of an intellectual concept, like that's what we'll do, we'll put sanctions on here. And there are smart sanctions you can put on, which generally are supposed to affect the regime or folks or rich financiers. What these sanctions do is basically, because of the actions of a few in the government, they affect the entire population. So they affect poor people, they affect rich people, they affect financiers, they affect the middle class. And what they have the intended result being is that you're going to unify the Iranian people back against the United States again. Remember, after September 11th, there were Iranians singing on the streets There were Iranians singing on the streets, God bless America, because they were, in a sense, unified with the United States. And this is after the whole history between the United States and Iran going back to 1953, when Mohammad Mossadegh was dislodged from power by the United States and Britain, in part because he nationalized the oil field, and then the Shah of Iran took over. And the Shah of Iran was in there till 1979, when you had the hostage crisis, and the Ayatollah came in, and then you had the U.S. supporting Iraq and Saddam Hussein against Iran during the 1980s, and then putting sanctions on Iran while supporting Saudi Arabia during their vociferous adversaries. So try to think of it from Iranian perspective, and now they see the United States, why they see us in a sense as a great Satan. And now there was this Barack Obama, one of his first speeches, he went to Cairo back in 2009, and he in a sense apologized for the United States for their role in the 1953 coup against the Mossadegh regime. And then Mitt Romney used that in 2012 to say, well, Barack Obama's going apologizing for America. So Iran, I think, from a United States perspective, they're seen as, in many respects, an adversary. But you have to differentiate certainly the regime and from the population of Iran. And the population of Iran, they are being hurt. They're having deleterious effects on them as well. And as a result, they, I think, are going to be supporting their government. Just like, for example, go back to the 1990s in Iraq, when the United States was trying to get Saddam Hussein out of power, so they put debilitating sanctions on Iraq. And as a result, it was the people who were the normal people who were affected, while Saddam Hussein, had a 294-foot yacht and had a palace in all 18 of the Iraqi provinces. So I don't see where the benefit of these sanctions is going to be in terms of taking down the regime. I think it's only going to unify the people and the regime against an external adversary, and that is the United States.
Well, Rich, I'm going to push back on one item when you suggested, remember that the Iranians were out on the streets singing God Bless America, and I'm only pushing back on that since in real time, Americans don't know what was in the Mueller report and think there was nothing bad said about Donald Trump in the Mueller report. I'm quite certain most Americans have absolutely no idea that the Iranian people actually had this show of support for the United States after September 11th. I'm actually going to leave the segment with Admiral Ken. What does this mean from a military perspective that negotiations seem to be that much more difficult? I believe there's the famous quote that says warfare is a movement of policy by other means. In this case, if those policies can't be discussed at a negotiating table, doesn't it make it a lot more dangerous for people who are in uniform?
Yeah, it does. And thanks for quoting von Clausewitz there. That's pretty good for especially for an Air Force guy. Listening to the news and, some of my neighbors who are taking concern about the movement of another 1,000 troops, bringing up the total over the last maybe 3 or 4 months at, just around 2,500 people. I think at the end of the day, Donald Trump, one thing he's been consistent about, and that's not wanting to do anything militarily in the Middle East. He doesn't want to do that. And I think there's a good number of people in his administration who both don't like John Bolton and are trying to shut him down. And I think Bolton's probably one of the biggest hawks that he's got working for him, especially when it comes to Iran. I tell you, when large numbers of ships start moving toward the Gulf and toward the Straits of Hormuz, that's when we need to start getting tense. That's when things are going to start making me worry. Not until then.
And with that, that's the end of this segment. And when we come back, we'll have some more to talk about, including Goodbye Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
Amen.
We'll have more to come back.
My man is acting like a heart that's good for nothing. Low down, I believed and trusted. Now I'm disgusted. I found him out, had a show. Down. When I think of him, how much I love him, I get a desperate notion. That's the way I feel today. My heart is aching because he's making a plaything of my devotion. That's the way I feel today. Without any reason or a word to say, that man turned his keys in, he packed and went away. What good is that? living. I'll soon be giving my body up to the ocean. That's the way I feel today.
Studio A in Podcast Village, Upper Georgetown, Washington, D.C. This is the best political talk show you've never heard of. It's Backroom Politics with your host and moderator, Justin Russell.
And welcome back, everyone. As you probably already guessed, I am not Justin Russell. I am your guest host, Dan Lipner. And for this next segment, first let me start off by wishing my dad a happy birthday. Today he is 76 years old. Happy birthday, Dad. And on that note, on the wishing him happy birthday, and I'm sure he's going to be very sad with this, but Rich, I'm going to start off with you. Sarah Huckabee Sanders is leaving the White House. Is she the best White House secretary, press secretary ever, or merely one of the best White House press secretaries ever?
Oh, that's like when Stephen Colbert used to ask the question of Democratic representatives, George W. Bush. Great president or the greatest president? I guess, how do you answer that? No, I don't think she will go down in the annals of history. I actually think in terms of press secretaries that will be remembered, one of them is certainly Mike McCurry from the Clinton administration. I think certainly the way he was able to deal with being there for the Monica Lewinsky scandal and still having respect from the press, I think he would be one of those that would be greatly respected. I think Marlon Fitzwater, certainly for the George H.W. Bush administration, who is well known. Or they have a school for it. They have a name. We're at Franklin Pierce College, for example. But no, I think that she's going to be remembered. This is someone who's only 36 years old, who basically had worked for his father, who was governor of Arkansas in her presidential campaign. She's become the public face card of the Trump administration, even though she hasn't had any public briefings in 96 days, believe it or not. And most presidents, it's pretty much just about every day they have some sort of a gaggle early in the morning, and then they have a press conference later in the day. But I think that her association with Donald Trump, specifically, the fact that if Donald Trump were to, for example, if Donald Trump is to resign in disgrace, whether he gets a second term, whether he resigns in disgrace, whatever happens, she's going to be associated with Donald Trump. Now, if Donald Trump's legacy is seen as positive, she will also be seen that in that respect. She will also be seen as somebody who is certainly
a advocate of Donald Trump, and certainly I was going back to the Nixon administration, for example. I know that there was Press Secretary Ziegler, who was certainly associated with him. But in terms of what her future is going to be, she's talking about now running for governor of Arkansas. And some people might say that this is an outlandish proposition, but Donald Trump is relatively popular in Arkansas and probably will remain popular in Arkansas. Her father served came into power after Jim Guy Tucker, who was Bill Clinton's successor, resigned in disgrace, basically. Huckabee came in 1996 and served for about three and a half terms. He's still relatively popular in the state, even though he moved to Florida and no longer lives in the state. You currently have Asa Hutchinson, the governor of Arkansas, who just got reelected overwhelmingly as a Republican. The state has turned very Republican. I think that in 2000, it would have to be 2022 if she were to seek the seat. There's also the possibility, perhaps, if John Bozeman were to retire at some point, or if Tom Cotton, the other United States senator, those are the two senators, if he were to resign at some point to take a position in the Trump
administration. That's a lot of political ambition that we're throwing at her. And I believe the governor's seat was something suggested by Trump in his little goodbye tweet about her. I don't recall her actually making a statement, but I could be mistaken.
But she is. Well, I just think I guess maybe it's some conjecture on my part. I just know that she is going back to Arkansas. And I know that the Trump brand is very popular in Arkansas. And I think that she can be seen as some kind of a martyr.
So that said, Admiral Ken.
Yeah.
She's had an impossible job. There must be something good to say about her.
Impossible. It's not an impossible job if you've got a soul. Okay, let's talk about something here. Okay, so number one, she said when on the heels of the president firing Jim Comey that she talked to countless FBI agents and they had stated to her that Comey had lost their confidence.
Yeah, countless. She didn't count any.
And yet when she was testifying under oath, she admitted that she'd made that up. Now, we all knew at some level that she was had a loose association with the truth at best. From the previous session, that's a slam dunk. So if the people of Arkansas want to elect someone like Donald Trump, who's got at best a loose association with the truth, as their governor, then I say go for it, my friends, and solidify almost every stereotype that people outside of Arkansas say about people from Arkansas.
Oof. Okay. So,
you know what?
So direct your complaints to Justin Russell at Backroom Politics. That said,
this is coming from a guy from Alabama.
I still maintain she has had a pretty impossible job.
You know what Dale Bumpers, when governor of Arkansas, used to say in his inaugural address, and he's 71, he said, we're no longer going to be saying thank God for Mississippi.
Alan Moore, there must be something good to say about Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
So
she's leaving.
She's thank you. I'm so intrigued with all with all the speculation on what she's planning to do. Rich, I just have to say, you know a lot of stuff. You really do. You don't need to share all of it every time.
And that was from Alan.
Yes.
in terms of all of these
possibilities in Arkansas, I believe she's going back to Arkansas because, A, it's where she grew up, and because, B, she's not welcome in Washington, D.C., or New York City, the places where typically prior press secretaries will go because they can often get media jobs. Just look at Sean Spicer's struggles, and he was only in the job less than a year, got into jams on being required to say things that he knew to be untrue, and was resisting against that, finally got replaced. Sarah Sanders was a different person in this regard. Ken accurately points out her biggest sin, and it's a big sin because it was wrong when she said it, and then demonstrably, provably wrong when the Mueller report came out, and she came up with some sort of a pathetic, weak excuse for, well, she misspoke. But then she kept misspeaking over the next couple of weeks on that same exact subject. I don't know what she's going to do. She's got three small children. She's got to find some sort of way to make a living. And I suppose there's perhaps a market for her in writing a book, maybe a market for her and some Trump loyalists who will pay to hear her speak. I mean, not only did she have this credibility problem, I don't blame her for not holding press briefings. That's something that the president decided, not Sarah Sanders. So, but having said that, who wants to hear from her anyway if she doesn't have anything to say, if her honesty is subject to question? And there is no way we're going to look to her to provide any kind of useful information. And in fairness, the president started doing his own, not necessarily daily, but several times a week.
I didn't want to cough over that one.
briefing as he walks out of the White House, heads to the helicopter and takes a few questions. Probably a huge relief to her. The other thing that she will be remembered for, and is appropriately vilified for, is to be a partner in the president's trashing of news people. And she would be confronted from time to time. So the president said that we are the enemy. Do you believe that? Could you clarify right now for the American people that we are not the enemy? And about the best she could come up with, well, maybe not all of you. And she did not under, she doesn't understand the world of journalism, the world of news in what be it print or broadcast, she has no friends anywhere in the whole structure of government. The media,
that's cold,
hate
man.
Her.
No friends?
Well, not that I could see. There's certainly no defense. I mean, there are people who say, like I might, wow, can you imagine having to be press secretary for this president and him ordering you to say things you know to be wrong, telling you not to speak on this sort of stuff, telling you not to have press briefings, and you take the flack for it. The only time she ever got anything sympathetic was at a big dinner, the radio and TV correspondence dinner, or White House correspondence dinner, where a paid comedian proceeded to just trash her in highly personal ways, her looks and so on, and people said, no, that's out of bounds. That's the best she ever got in terms of defense from people, other than this sympathetic comment about working for Donald Trump. But she made that choice to do that and to continue to do that. I don't know what she's going to do. Maybe she'll run for office in Arkansas. I mean, the first thing she needs to do is take a breath, try to see if she's got any friends left. I don't know about the family, her and her husband's employment, their financial situation, and so on. That's something that they've got to pay some attention to.
Oh, I am certain there must be a Chinese toy manufacturer that uses lead-based paint in their toys that needs a new comm specialist to talk about the liberal bias against lead in children's toys. I mean, she would be perfect for that. I'm just certain of it. But that said, the stepping back from it a little bit, since we've all been making fun of her at her expense that she deserves. That said, what do we think the long-lasting effects of her as the White House press secretary for more than 2 years is going to be on the long-term effects of between the White House and the media? Not just this White House, but future White Houses.
Yeah, you know, the die is cast for this White House. I think the future won't necessarily be directly affected. We have had a lot of change in the world of media. And different kinds of behaviors and new ground rules that everybody's having to adjust to. But I think this is kind of a one-off experience with this president and his press secretaries, and we'll see who comes next. So I'm not in a position to say, oh, he's ruined, that it's been ruined for indefinitely or into the indefinite future. I think it's pretty unique to this president.
Admiral Ken, any long-term effects of Sarah Huckabee Sanders?
I think that the next press secretary that comes along with the next administration will have the unique ability to restore a tremendous amount of norms that I think we, you know, we took for granted until Donald Trump and his group of press secretaries made their presence known.
Well,
I'm hoping that whoever that man or woman is understands the situation, the historical situation that they're going to be in, and that they do some things that that, you know, we stand back away from the television, or if you're lucky enough to be in the room at the end of every day and go, wow, my God, we're back where we're supposed to be.
I mean, Rich Rubino, playing devil's advocate here for the White House, and as you correctly pointed out, it's been more than, I believe, 96 days since they've had a regular press briefing. They've also shown there hasn't, aside from the Washington press corps, there actually hasn't been a huge uprising of complaints about this lack of a press briefing. If the administration can move on their own without need of the press, why bother?
No, it's a very good point, and the president certainly has his own way of using the press. He does, you know, he realizes that the people that are going to be more sympathetic to him are the ones that he's going to award with interviews, and certainly Fox News is one of them, for example. Many talk radio shows around the country, conservative talk radio shows. He knows how to play the press that he likes against the establishment press. Kind of, he would say that this is, you know, the conservative press. This is where the real America is, I guess he would say. And they don't necessarily share the liberal bias, whereas the establishment press, he would say, has a liberal agenda and you shouldn't necessarily listen to them. But in terms of the press secretary, I mean, I think part of the reason there hasn't been an outrage is, I mean, I don't think that, and this goes back to any previous administration, if you asked, you know, who was the press secretary to have, my guess is for, you know, any other administration, half the population wouldn't know. You know, it's a very specific group of people, I think, who actually would watch a press briefing or would actually pay attention to what a press secretary says. I think that they view when the president comes up and does a press conference or goes to the podium himself, people are more focused on that. I don't think people are necessarily that focused on what, you know, his press underlings would say. That's why I think that in terms of a new administration comes in, there'll be somebody who's going to be a lot more accessible to the press. But I don't think that this is a long term relationship between the president and the press. It's just that President Trump is used for his political advantage. The fact that he wanted somebody who's going to be somewhat adversarial, because for him, and you're going to see him when he runs for re-election, as much as whoever the Democratic nominee is going to be his opponent, the press is going to be part and parcel of the Democratic nominee, and he's going to try to make the case that the establishment press is part of the Democratic Party and that they're just kind of a wing of the Democratic Party.
Ellen Moore.
Yeah, so one thing that has come out of this is that in her comments upon leaving, Sarah Sanders made the well-intentioned but unfortunate comment that she hopes to be remembered as trustworthy and honest. transparent and honest. And that has created...
And she wasn't ironic at all when saying that.
That has created some hilarious other tweets from people all around saying, yeah, and I'm hoping to be remembered as Barack Obama, or I'm hoping to be remembered as this or that. But probably the best of all, the one that just went viral, was Stormy Daniels, who said, yes, and I look forward to being remembered as a virgin.
And fair point. But continuing on that train just for a little bit, this White House leaks more than a little bit, and we'll probably end up covering this in the next segment as well. But the amount of leaks that come out of this White House, unsourced, which the president has complained about, and the lack of a White House press briefing, is there any correlation to that? Or is this just how this administration happens to go, regardless of how the press works? Rich Rubino.
I don't think. I think that's just certainly the way this I think that this administration has kind of fawned onto that. But I think that, you know, for most presidents, the presidential daily briefing is something that happens every day. You know, it's usually kind of fun to watch the press secretary comes up and gives talking points about some sort of a program or, you know, something that they're doing for crime prevention or school uniforms or something like that. Talks about a minute or two, and then the press immediately start bringing up the issue of some sort of a scandal or something that the president doesn't want to talk about. The interesting thing that specifically I'll say about this president, though, is when it comes to the scandal, he actually brings up no collusion. He brings up the Mueller report for every, I mean, you know, you can go back to any other administration, and it was very rare that they would actually mention a scandal. In 1974's State of the Union address, for example, Richard Nixon actually said, you know, 1 year of Watergate is enough, and the American people were stunned that he would actually mention the word Watergate without it being mentioned specifically to him. So I think that, but I think that the press briefing, certainly whoever comes into the next administration, it will be more of a daily event. It won't be something that you're going to have every 150 days.
So let's make this a little bit bigger here, because while we're all making fun of Sarah Huckabee Sanders, but this is a serious situation. I'm looking back at my memory of the announcement of coalition forces moving for the first Iraq war, the presidential statements for the second Iraq war, Bill Clinton and the White House press briefings during the campaign in Bosnia, the issues in Somalia, or even the sending in the Marines to Haiti, the ways that the presidency is affected and how that is communicated. With the Secretary of Defense not being a confirmed person at the moment, nor a White House press secretary that is a familiar face, presumably unless Donald Trump reaches into the Fox News annals of any of their commentators to be the next White House press secretary. It's been done before. Tony Snow. So the question is, what does this mean to the American public as without having a trusted face in any of those positions? Admiral Ken, as somebody who's been fought some of these wars, are you bothered that there doesn't seem to be a trusted public face in any of those places?
That's a Sophie's Choice kind of question, Dan. Do I want the president to stand up and do whatever he's been doing as he's climbing onto the helicopter and deliver his version of his reality, or do I want one of his appointees to do it? At the end of the day, crap is crap, and so I gotta admit I'm not so much bothered or worried about it. When I was in uniform, when we were doing Desert Storm, honestly, we were too busy to look at the daily presidential briefing anyway. we were a little occupied.
Yeah, but your friends and family were watching those things, getting an idea of what you were doing.
I guess maybe you might have to talk to my mom or my former spouse to get their perspectives on it. But my perspective on it is that honestly, I would like to see an honest face out of that White House. Period. In the story, either in the body of the president or one of his functionaries. I don't care who, and not getting a regular dump on a daily basis of BS. I don't know. I think it's kind of a refreshing deal right now. I'm kind of digging Sarah's silence right now.
Okay, I'm going to throw this jump ball between Alan and Rich, who wants to bring us out of this segment to as far as the history of the press secretary and talking to the American public.
Well, I'll say one thing, and then I'll defer to Rich, and I think, but I think it was touched on before. Most people, I think Rich was generous when he said half the people wouldn't know who the press secretary was. No, I would say half of 1% of the people might know who the press secretary is, and that's just fine. Now, some of these people have been able to capitalize on their visibility, and make a career elsewhere. In the media, but the idea is not that they become personalities in their own right who are highly recognized. Credible journalists don't want that job because you're a spokesperson. You're concealing and bending news. You're not seeking it out. You're not even getting the chance to comment on it. And so there's always been a challenge to find people in the business who would want to come and do it, even though they might see it as a career change, a chance to move on. Sadly, two of the best known people are Sean Spicer and Sarah Sanders, and it's not a good thing for them.
And Rich Rubino.
Yes, and it actually goes back to the Hoover administration, the office. But I'll say this in terms of a press secretary that actually I think made news himself. The one I'm thinking of is actually Gerald Terhorst, and this was in the Ford administration. And when Ford pardoned Nixon back in 1974, he actually resigned his post. He'd been there for that month, Remember, Gerald Ford came in. He had job approval ratings at about 78%. It went precipitously down to about 48% the day he did that. And he made news because of that. He did it as an act of conscience. But I think in terms of taking the job as a press secretary, remember, it kind of gives the impression to the American people, to the point that they care at all, that it's really a revolving door between being an impartial, uncolored observer in the press, somebody who's covering the White House or covering or something to that effect, and then going the other way, and then immediately you're part of the administration. Now, it can work the other way as well. I mean, George Stephanopoulos, for example, came to fame. I mean, he worked for Dick Gephardt. He worked for Bill Clinton. Certainly, that's where he became known for. You know, he was the first press secretary in the Clinton administration. But now he then went over to ABC News, and he's now seen as, you know, an independent journalist. But, you know, you just have to realize that you're seen as being a partisan of a certain for a certain candidate, even if your views don't necessarily align directly with that candidate.
And one last word from Alan. And then
just a word on Gerald Tohurst, the above the previously mentioned press secretary to Gerald Ford. He was a Detroit newspaper man. He knew Ford. Ford brought him in. He had the job. Tohurst did not resign because of the pardon. He resigned because he was not in the loop on the pardon, and he thought, I can't function.
And with those last words, we'll wait to see C.J. Craig giving the next press briefing. And that is our show. Thank you, everyone, for listening. This is Backroom Politics, and we'll see you later this week. Thanks, everyone.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.